You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I am, as ever, with Orla Shinoui.
Hello, Richard.
And, well, we're in a very special place, and we're joined by a special guest this month, Tiffany Cromwell.
Hi, thanks for having me.
The Canyon SRAM rider, a resident of Monaco, where we are sitting.
Almost. I'm actually on the border, but we can say I'm in Monaco.
We're in Monaco right now. We're definitely in Monaco
we
now.
We are enjoying the Dolce Vita, the warm winter sun.
It's beautiful. We're in mid-October and it feels like, well, it feels like the height of summer.
Summer in UK on like one of those rare blue sky days, right?
A lot of building work going on in Monaco. They seem to be rebuilding Monaco. Is that a constant here? We were struggling to get away from the drills and the machinery.
I feel like they're always doing something here. They're ripping down buildings, creating new ones. I think we're going to have building out on the sea for quite some time as they're reclaiming land from the sea to extend Monaco and give it some more surface area.
Just when we need more Monaco.
Exactly. Never enough in these 2 square kilometres.
How long have you lived here now?
It'll be 7 years next year. So
settled?
I am. I feel very settled. You know, I've got a great community here. It's sort of become my home away from home. I spend 10 months a year based down here. And yeah, it took some time to find my feet, but now it feels very much like I'm a part of the community.
And you have an interesting life here. We're going to talk about that later on in the podcast. So it's a podcast of two halves. We're going to talk a bit about some of the current newsy stuff in part one, and then we're going to talk to Tiffany about her life in cycling, because you've kind of lived through a lot of changes in women's cycling, and you kind of were there at the start of what we might call the modern era. Good. What on earth is that going on out there? There's someone on a...
Oh, that's the flyboard.
Where? Oh, yeah. My God.
There's someone like walking in the air, walking on water.
It's the return of the good Lord.
I've actually done that before.
Witnessing.
It's quite fun.
Yeah. I've always wanted to try that though, but this is it. It looks cool when somebody can do it like that. Well, I don't know if it does look cool, but it's a bit odd.
We need a photograph of this to prove it's actually happened.
Well, I'm filming it, so I might be able to pick it up for our YouTube. But whenever you see people who can't do it, they basically just, they get farted into the air and then fall over, don't they?
Exactly.
What's it called?
It's a flyboard, or flyboarding. So basically it's attached to the jet ski, and it's the power of the jet ski exhaust of the water that goes through a tube, through the boots, that ejects you up out of the water. Then you can like do the dolphin thing if you YouTube it. It's very cool. Or you can do like flips and stuff like that, but... He's obviously doing it on his own, but I've done it when they were controlling the power of the water.
Have you got pictures or videos of you doing it?
Maybe somewhere, but I'll have to find. It was quite a long time ago.
If you do, will you send them? We need to see it. Richard, do you think we'd have time for you to give that a go before we have to get our flight back?
Definitely. I don't need the equipment. So you're listening to the Flyboarding podcast sponsored by Rafa. But back to cycling. We're in the off-season. It's so short. You were telling us you're off to Australia soon, and the racing starts again there pretty early, and you've got some big sort of early season targets, you hope. But how do you reflect on this season?
For me personally, I felt like it was a bit flat. Like, I had a few highlights throughout the year. You know, I did get the stage win in the Tungan Rundfahrt. And the back end of the season was certainly a lot more successful than the start. But I did took some time to find my feet. And in the team as well, you know, it took our little bit of time before we got success. But that aside, it was still, you know, great year with the Canyon SRAM racing team. It was always a fantastic group of girls that I get to race with day in, day out. But... you know, as with things, you have your ups and downs, and it's when you have your downs that make you stronger for when it comes back up. And, you know, did some soul searching, I guess you could say, or altitude training, and then, came back stronger. And the season finished earlier than I would have hoped, but in a way it's good because it set me up with, you know, I already feel prepared, refreshed, ready to get back into the season, because as we say, next year's important with the Commonwealth Games in Australia. So the January racing's got to be really important for me. So I'll be targeting to have a strong start of the season.
So what did you need that soul searching, Tiffany? What prompted that and what did that involve?
I think it was more a case of, so the start of the season, you know, normally the classics are my favourite races, but I just couldn't seem to find my mojo. Things just weren't coming together how I would have hoped. And then it's like, okay, when you have certain goals, you don't reach those goals. You have to then reflect and question why. and what do we need to change. You know, with the team, we had a few injuries and illnesses, so then I was called up to do some extra racing that wasn't planned. So looking back, I didn't get enough of the training blocks in between the race blocks. It was just a really, really, really heavy spring part. And I think it was just a matter of I just need to step back and just have some time to train. And it was that find places that I enjoy. So I went to Colorado for a period after Tour of California. And for me, it's always been a happy place. I lived in Colorado when I was racing in the States, and when I've been back since, you know, it's one of those places where it's just, I don't know if it's the thin air or the beautiful scenery, but you just find the joy of cycling again. And it's just about trying to find why you love the sport, particularly being in it for so long. Like, sometimes for me personally, I need those periods to just be away from the racing scene, away maybe from my home life, and just to just go and ride my bike and get that general fitness, be somewhere that you love, and just being outside.
Actually, you featured in our, Alexis Ryan kept a diary for us at the Tour of California. You were her roommate there, and you didn't have a great race, I don't think. You didn't finish the race, and you did go off one day and do some monster ride, didn't you? Did you not get lost or something?
I didn't get lost, but yeah, so California is definitely probably the lowest point of the season. Like, I've always suffered with altitude at the time of being there, but I always reflect really well from altitude. So we went to California first stage, you know, I got dropped on the first climb, which personally, like, I knew like I was better than that, and you know, for me it was really hard to take. And then the time cut was really, really short on that day. They said, sorry, no, you guys are done. So obviously I was like super disappointed, to not only for my own performance but to let down the team and to be there. So then I was like, okay, how do we bounce back from this? I still had to hang around until I was flying out of San Francisco a few days later. So I was like, well, I need to ride my bike. So I decided I'll make the ride from Tahoe back down to Sacramento, which on paper you think, okay, it's all downhill, but actually it isn't, which I also knew because I went the more scenic route. And it was a beautiful, beautiful ride for the first maybe 100K. But it was a 230, 240K solo. I started at 6 o'clock in the morning. It was freezing cold, but it was the last 60K or 100K that was block headwind, a straight road, just got slowly busier and hotter. That was some character building moments there. And I think it took me about 7 hours, and you know, I think that's like, I have done some long rides before, but with groups, never by myself, and never that long time-wise solo. Like, it was a long day. By the end, I was definitely, you know, dead from that. But it was one of those kind of adventure rides. You just do it to challenge yourself to say, yep, all right, let's do this.
Good effort. sorry for thinking you got lost. You actually rode that distance deliberately.
Yeah.
I just assumed you'd got lost when I heard about it.
I'm crazy sometimes.
If you want to listen to that Alexis Ryan audio diary, become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's very entertaining. And what really comes across, and a lot of people commented on this, is there's a sort of joy to it. She talks, Alexis, a lot about really enjoying it, enjoying riding her bike, as you were just talking about, enjoying racing. And you were talking, Tiffany, about you can sometimes lose that. And how important is it to have that? And is it something you generally do have, that you sort of do appreciate, that you're lucky to do what you do? Which, to be honest, you don't always find among the male riders.
Yeah, 100%. I think definitely in the women's peloton, you feel it a bit more than the men's peloton. I think anybody, though, who does this sport, you have to love it to do it, because you do make a lot of sacrifices. It requires a huge amount of dedication, a huge amount of discipline. Like, you have to pack up your life, move other places, spend a lot of time on the road away from either your partners, your family, your friends, anyone. Like, the men's side, okay, they have obviously a lot more lucrative contracts, which makes it a lot easier to just, it becomes more like work for them. For the women, I think, particularly in the early years when there was very, very minimal money within the sport, we did all do it because we love the sport. And, you know, because if you're doing it for pennies, then you want to be doing it because you love it, not because it's your job. Now, like, things are changing, which is exciting. But for sure, when you can say, hey, this is my job, this is what I do, all I have to do is ride my bike. Yeah, there's the hard days. Yeah, there's the dark days. Yeah, you know, a great quote, because we've had Eric Zabel come with us a few times because he works with Canyon. And I remember him saying one time, he's like, you know, when the highs, they're really high, but the lows are really low. And that's so true. It's like, it's just this roller coaster road. But, you know, when you do have those highs, there's no better feeling. And to be able to do a job that you love, you're never going to work a day in your life, really.
Now, tell us about, there was a little, well, quite a big controversy towards the end of the season around the Australian team at the World Championships. We didn't cover this, actually, in last month's
podcast. No, we didn't get time to. We ran out of time. And I think it's something that is very important to discuss, and the reasons behind it, and I think this, what it says maybe about the state of where we view women's cycling compared to men's cycling still. I mean, certainly it's specific to Australia, yeah. But
we better tell people what it was. Yeah. I mean, So there was a controversy over the selection of the Australian team for the World Road Race Championship, and they didn't fill the quota, basically, decided to go with a smaller team, leaving out the likes of yourself, Chloe Hosking, and there was quite an uproar about it, obviously, and they relented. You decided, I think, not to go. Just tell us about that, what unfolded and why you made that decision.
It was quite disappointing from the start of how, you know, Australia handled the situation, you know, coming from a country that we are lucky that we do have a lot of support. We have, you know, amazing amount of government support through, you know, funding, through performances at different levels. But there are years when, okay, sure, I would say Australia doesn't deserve necessarily to have a full quota if we haven't performed. But, you know, we have a new head of high performance, Simon Jones. He came from the British system. And so they did, like, there did need to be changes after Australia as a whole, as a nation, not only in cycling, but in many, many sports, didn't perform to the level that we wanted at the Rio Olympics. So as part of the change with Cycling Australia, they got a new head of high performance. They want to make some radical changes. And with that, it's been focused on development and where we can get the medals from. So, of course, you know, track is going to always take a high focus because there's a lot more medals and things filter down. So road, not so many opportunities for medals. But with that, they said, okay, we don't think Australia, well, early on we said maybe there's a chance that they're not going to take full teams, men, women, U23 across the board. When it came down to it, it was only the women that told, sorry, we're taking five riders. And for me, you know, I was pretty vocal about the decision because I've come through the years for many years with the Australian program. I've been from when we had the golden era of the likes of Sarah Carrigan and Oney Wood, Liv Goll and all that lot. They were retired just after the Beijing Olympics. And then since then, we've really been kind of regrow like the women's side of the sport. And this year, hands down, we've had our most successful year across the board for women's cycling. You know, there was a reason why we became third ranked nation in the world. And it wasn't because of one rider's results. It was collectively we had strong results across the board. Were we a favourite? No, not for the rainbow jersey. Were we a chance for a podium? Yes. And with that, it was kind of like the reasons we got told, the reasons that Simon Jones said, sorry, they don't deserve to have the full quota. That was really pathetic, in my honest opinion, you know, to say that and not have legitimate leg to stand on. It's like, did you truly believe what you said, or were you just saying it because that's what you want to say? Because it's easier to say that instead of saying, no, we'll take a full squad because that's what the women need if they want the best chance. So, yeah, with that then, like for me, Plouay was the last selection race. I got told after that from the national coach, okay, five riders, like, okay, done, season's done, whatever, I'm not going to fight it. I'll just take it, like, about, you know, take on the chin and focus on the next season. Then when it all came out, people appealed, then everything else, then they got the positions back. At that point, I was already in vacation mode. You know, I'd already planned a trip to New York, all this. Like, maybe if I knew there was a chance of potentially still going, then I would have trained because it was a goal for me. Like, that course, I believe I could have been good on, whether going for the result or helping the team. And then, so for me, I just knew, like, deep down, I wouldn't have been able to perform to the level that I needed to be an asset to the Australian team. So I just had to, you know, clean the slate, say, okay, this year Worlds isn't for me. At least we got seven spots. That's what we needed. At least we had girls that stood up to the federation to say we need to be taken seriously. We deserve these spots. We deserve to be treated equally and given the best chance to get results. And in the end, we did. We had a fantastic World Championships, and kudos to the girls for that.
So why do you think then? What was the real reason for not selecting a full quota?
To be honest, I really don't know. Like, it's just the development pathways for anything aside from track in Australian cycling at the moment with their new target of Tokyo and medals and everything else. I just feel like realistically on the likelihood of the chance, probability of a medal, they just think it's better to invest into track where it's like 1 in 20 can get a medal versus 1 in 150 or whatever, or 1 in 80 for the Olympics. That's the only thing I can put it down to.
Simon,
you know,
Jones, of course, does come from the British program. He's worked in Australia as well, but he came back and worked with Team Sky for a couple of years, and he was appointed to the top job in Australia. And it does sound very like the British approach sort of 10, 15 years ago, where the resources were concentrated almost entirely on track racing.
And the other thing with the British comparison, though, is that, yeah, 10, 15 years ago, and we think that it's maybe moved on slightly, but one of the things that has struck me from speaking to Lizzie Deignan this year, and we spoke to her at the launch of her book, was that I've been labouring under the misapprehension, for example, in the British system, that the women's road team is at the very least on a road level given the same support or a similar support level of support to the men's, yep. which has not been the case at all. How does it compare in Australia?
Yeah, it's hard to say, you know, because at the end of the day, the funding comes from the medals and then it's filtered down. So in the past, the women's program has relied a lot on the funding that's come from the medals from the track because we haven't had the medals ourselves. Whereas now, okay, we brought home 2 medals in the senior and 1 from the junior. Is that going to change? Like, I've definitely benefited from some funding from the women's program, but the men still, at the end of the day, when you get to the World Championships, it's the pro men are always the top of the pecking order. Then it filters down. And, you know, so I can't complain in terms of the support that I've had when I've needed. I've also been lucky that I've been with a good professional team, that I've had enough support from them and haven't relied on having that second element of the funding like some of the girls. You know, if they don't have that extra funding from the National Federation, then they'll probably struggle a bit more to do the full road season. You know, the men, they don't rely on that because they get, as we say, you know, they have the contract, so actually they don't filter under the guidelines to allow them to get any funding from the Federation. But if they need physio, if they need doctors, if they need coaching and support, you know, the Federation's there. But I think it's just because, you know, road is different because 95% of the time we race with trade teams. We don't race with the Federation. It's only those World Championships, Olympic Games, Commonwealth Games. Maybe if you do a national team race that you're racing under the Australian bans. Whereas on the track, you know, it's all controlled. It's all national teams. So they have their camps, they have their programs. So then obviously they need this different support. That's where it's like that tricky things like, okay, we need the support of our nation because we want to represent them, but we also have our job with our trade team. And it's also then how do you make that successful team on a road race when you race as a national team when you come from different teams?
And what is the answer to that really difficult question as well, as to who is right in terms of Simon Jones concentrating on medals, which yep. is what the government will care about, how funding is measured, and the need to be well represented as a nation across the board, and I guess the value of sport in inspiring kids, and if kids don't have any pathway to come through because they don't see the elite being represented at the Olympics and whatnot. I mean, that's a really difficult balance and it's a really difficult question to answer, isn't it?
100%. And, you know, I still believe, like, I'd rather see money get put into the development pathways for the road, because at the moment now we have no pathways. And like we say, you know, when a lot of us are all a similar age who are representing Australia currently and who are in the top of high performance, both on the men, okay, it's a little bit more stretched out, but on the women's side, you know, what happens when we retire? Are there going to be another crop of young women coming through that have those pathways to then come through into the professional ranks? And, you know, coming from Australia, when it's a country so far away, you need that pathway. Like, I was lucky at the time when I came through, we did have the national program. So I had that chance to get the stair step to go from Australia. Okay, I had the opportunity to race in America too with the team over there. But then I had the national program to race in Europe and get seen by European teams. Now, you know, we're losing that part. And you can do it on your own. People have showed you can do it on your own. Like, Chloe Hosking is a perfect example. She didn't use the national program. But to have that pathway, you know, it makes a huge difference. And I think that's where the focus needs to be. Yes, on the medals, but to keep the high performance, we need the development pathways and how they handle that. You know, they need to sort that out. But I don't think it should be missed completely. Yes, we need the medals, but we need the development too.
Given your disappointment at missing out in the World Championships, did you watch the road race? I mean, if you're not racing, do you watch a lot of bike racing?
Truth be told, I don't often watch that much bike racing. Usually when I'm on the massage table and I have my massage therapist with me, then we'll turn it on. But I was actually doing the back end of the London to Monaco charity ride for the Blue Marine Foundation. So that day, I think, I can't remember where we've ridden. It was somewhere in Provence, somewhere. It was beautiful. But I did see the last 2 laps of it because that's, you know, when we got to the hotel. And it was exciting to see, but yeah, I was following on Twitter and those sorts of things because, you know, I did have the vested interest to see what happens. But, you know, I'm not one of these people that sit down religiously and watch every single bike race.
Chantal Black, new world champion. It was a very dominant Dutch display. But I was going to ask you, who's impressed you this year?
Chantal, I was actually teammates with her a couple of years ago, and I was really happy to see her win the world title. Like, the Dutch were definitely a force to be reckoned with. It was their race to lose, and she's a very, very worthy world champion. Like, when she made that attack, I was like, you never give her an inch, because as soon as she went, I was like, she's won the race. You know, she's that type of rider. She's a strong, powerful rider. I say Cassie Neodoma, she was a very, very strong rider this year. She lacked maybe having some strength within her team to get her that next level. But, you know, we've seen her growing every year, like getting stronger and stronger, and, you know, she's becoming a very complete bike rider. And then from the Australian side, I think Sarah Roy, you know, it was great to see her step up. Like, she's, you know, coming into her prime in terms of race age where you peak for women. But I really like her as a person, you know. I know her as a friend, and I've been teammates with her before, and I know enthusiasm and love of cycling, and it's exciting to see some of the Aussies step up. And, you know, someone like her, who I remember 3 years ago, she almost didn't have a contract. And it was actually the fact that I was going to go back to Orica at one point, and I didn't go there, that she then got the contract renewed. And then, she, you know, she's just had this upward projectile, and, you know, it's great to see from an Australian point of view.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the cycling podcast Femina. If you want some Science in Sport goodies, go to scienceinsport.com, enter the code CPAUG20 in the checkout, and you'll get 20% off. 20% off. That's very good.
Wow.
I mean, it's been that all year, so I'm not... But it's an excellent deal. I know lots of listeners have been taking advantage of that, and do go and stock up on your fuel for the winter, because you need to fuel properly in the winter.
Can I enter a secret? I don't know if it's allowed, but I have it in normal life. Is that allowed?
What?
Is that,
you have what in normal
like,
life?
Like, does it make you feel sporty? Sport fuel products. Science
gels
sport
and things.
Stuff. Well, not necessarily gels, because that's
gel when you're going down the metro.
I went for a gentle swim once and had a protein recovery shake instead of lunch, which is that cheating?
No, you did some sport.
It explains
it's okay.
a lot, Orla. It explains a lot. I think now I understand. It's not just energy balls, is it? We've got a terrible energy ball story, haven't we?
We do.
On this trip.
I know.
Joe Dombrowski showed an interest in energy balls, so Orla cooked him a batch. And,
me and my daughter prepared double batch together.
Yeah, brought them over and lost them somewhere on the plane. They're rolling around the floor.
Well, the thing is, so I packed them really sort of meticulously in a Tupperware with a nice little bit of kitchen roll, nicely presented. And then I took out a smaller Tupperware for me and Richard to have a little snack on the plane. So we wolfed ours down, no problem. And then I couldn't find the one that I brought as the gift. And this morning on the train from Nice to Monaco, I was looking up something on my phone, and I opened up the last Google page that I had on my phone, and the Google page was a search that I put in food in hand luggage on planes to see if I was allowed to bring it. And I wanted to cry.
At that point, she began crying.
Yeah. Go back to the moment where I still thought I could deliver on my promise of energy balls.
Well, one consolation is they were very tasty. At least we managed
You're
to have
good,
a couple.
They're good, Joe. They're the best,
maybe you can send it to him.
I've already promised I will, you see, so now I have to deliver on that. But I added figs this time. That was my little secret. Ooh, nice. There we go.
Anyway, back to the matter in hand. We'll maybe move on to talk about some of the other developments in women's cycling, notably the new Movistar team with Tiffany, because the landscape is very different now, it seems, to what it was when you first came over to Europe. I mean, well, tell us, even before that, how did you become a bike rider?
Yeah, so my story is kind of interesting, I guess you could say. Cycling kind of found me. I came through a talent search program in Australia. So I've always been very, very sporty. Like, believe it or not, I played basketball for 8 years, despite my height.
Wow.
Yeah. Always did some running. I did ballet when I was younger. And through school, we did our general fitness tests, like your shuttle run, your vertical jump, basketball throw, all this. And through various physiologies, so the State Sports Institute, they were like, oh, okay, you have potential to be a football player, a bike rider, whatever. So I got invited to come try cycling at the velodrome, got handed a bike, no brakes, got put into a velodrome with these huge bankings. If anybody knows how intimidating it can be when you first go into a velodrome, said, go ride around. So we did two sessions of that and then got put in the lab for a VO2 max test. And after that, got invited into the program. And with about, I think, 10 or 12 other kids in the same situation. And then from there, you know, we had a year under the Talent ID program, and the rest
so what
is history.
What age were you then?
I was 12.
Had you done much riding before then? Had it been part of your childhood much in any way?
Only, you know, mucking around on the street or on BMX bikes or whatever, but, you know, never properly. And this whole, like, when you saw Leica, and back then, you know, cycling wasn't anywhere near as popular as it is now. It's like, what is this, you know? I was used to wearing, like, baggy clothes and everything else. Like, I'd been a big tomboy through a period of my life as well. So, yeah, it was definitely nothing that I've ever done before like that.
Similar to your friend Lizzie Dagnan, who lives here as well, but she discovered cycling, or cycling discovered her in a similar way. So you obviously you obviously liked it. Did you?
Truth be told, I actually did like it.
You're still doing it.
Yeah. No, it's funny because I still very much love basketball. It'd been so much of my life, and I was one of the worst in the group on the track. Like, I was tiny when I started. I think I was about 35 kilo and 140 centimetres, so, you know, a whippet. And, yeah, I was on the track. Yeah, I wasn't, but I still did it just because it was something to do. And then we start on the road, and first race was the state championships, and I got third. And after that, I was like, oh, maybe I like this. Then I started travelling. Like, I never got to travel when I was younger. My dad was self-employed. Mum had a normal job. So the biggest travel we did was either go to Melbourne or go, you know, to the coast or something. So, yeah, I started travelling around Australia and started getting a little bit stronger. And, yeah, from there, then I started to enjoy cycling more and basketball less. I still probably did the two sports for a good year or two, and then finally I went more and focused more on the cycling, and ever since then I've just had that nice progressive, you know, slow upward trajectory. I never had that really big bang, crazy, amazing year, and then trying to replicate that. It's just been, you know, a few results here, a few opportunities there, and, you know, I've said my progression in the sport's been quite a good one to have.
Was there a moment though where you realised it could be a career?
Yeah, definitely. I think probably when I made it more full-time in Europe, you know, the early years. So I spent some time, I got found in Australia racing when we used to have the Geelong World Cup and New Zealand Tour actually. And there we had Colavita Sutter Home, a US-based team. They were out racing by me to be a guest rider in America, and still I was super green. I was like just turned 19 or something, so still underage in America. So got to, you know, travel with that, race that. But it's still very much for fun. Then I had the opportunity through the national program to do racing in Europe as well. But I guess probably more like 2010 when I started actually getting some money in the bank account, more than just expenses, that I'm like, oh, maybe I can make this into a job. But it still probably wouldn't be until 2012, I'd say, when I first went to Orica at then. It was called Green Edge, where it became more of a job and less of a, okay, this is like a good, that, fun.
Quite recently then, really, in you're 29 now, aren't you? So describe what was it like in Europe, you know, before then? What was the scene like? Because you've raced for a lot of teams as well.
Because 2010 as well is when you moved to Monaco, wasn't it?
No, 2010 was in Girona. 2011 to Monaco. But yeah, 2010 was my first full year in Europe after balancing half in the US, half in Europe. It's definitely changed a huge amount. Up until 2012, I'd say the sport was still very, very small. Like back then we had the two dominant teams, which was Cervelo Test Team and HTC High Road, or when it was also like, was it Columbia. In its various iterations.
Guises, yeah.
You know, back when you had the likes of Udathan, you had Ina Jokud Teutenberg. I still remember my first ever introduction with Ina. Like, she was so intimidating. She was like the boss of the peloton. Or even Giorgia Bronzini, I first met her, like, or remembered seeing her. I was a junior. I went to a race in Italy with the women's team, and I couldn't race because first year juniors weren't allowed to race senior races, but second year could. And I was with Amanda Spratt. And so she raced and I just stayed in the car. And that's when I first got introduced to this person. Oh, this is Giorgia Bronzini, you know.
Did you know of her?
No, I didn't. You know, just got told, you know, she was this crazy sprinter. But yeah, then with Ina, I remember I was the best young rider in the Geelong Tour, I think, in 2006. And I was on the podium with her, Anoni Wood, which Anoni, she was one of our most successful riders on the road at the time. And I just remember being so intimidated by her. I was like, oh, who is this? You know, these girls who are like, you know, so dominant and like the bosses of the peloton. And I was just this young, enthusiastic junior coming through. Yeah, so back then you really had the two kind of super teams. And outside of that, there wasn't anything more. I've also been with Marianne Vos my whole career as well. You know, I first raced her as a junior in 2005 because she's always been a year older than me. But I think back then you could race and win races as individuals. I think the biggest change we've seen is the aspect of the team side of the sport. Certainly also from the Olympics onwards, we've seen the big change as well in terms of the exposure within the sport. People realising, okay, it's an exciting sport, we want to see more. The age of social media has been a huge, huge help to the sport as well, and that's what's brought more money into it. It's shown more personalities. Teams have realised, okay, we have a platform, a free platform, we can show the sport, we can show the people, we can give something back to our sponsors, because that, at the end of the day, is the only way to try and keep sponsors within the sport. So, you know, it's been interesting watching it change, you know, also in terms of people knowing the riders. Back when I started, no one really knew who anyone was, even like the best in the world, like Judith or Ina. But now I feel like we have profiles in the sport, even outside. Like you look at Lizzie Dignam, for example, in the UK, she's got a huge profile, or like Pauline Framfort in our team in the French public as well. Like as female athletes, we can start to make a living from this sport. You know, when I first started, I was like, I was doing it 100% for fun. I was lucky I had very, very supportive people around me, whether it was through the national team, through my family supporting me, through my partners who I've had in my life. I've been lucky to have that network, whereas not everyone's had that opportunity to do this. And that's why we saw a lot of girls probably, or women probably, retire a lot earlier than what they necessarily had the potential. You know, they could have the potential to go a lot further, but at the end of the day, they wanted to have money in the bank account. They wanted to have a family so that would, like, stop the sport prematurely.
So one of the things that is often said about women's cycling is we look at the rate of change and we look at the negatives, really, at what it's not. And it's not as far advanced as the men's, or it's not as professional, or it's not as well paid. But to listen to you talking about the change over the last 7 years only, it has evolved an awful lot. How do you see that rate of change and where we are?
You know, I think it's exciting to see the change. For sure, you know, there is a lot that still needs to be done, a lot to get to the level that it should be. But I think we're living in a time of the world, a time of age where women's sport, there's a big movement for it. Like, you look not only in cycling, you look at women's football, you look at women's cricket, rugby. You know, we had Australian Rules Football did their first season in Australia and it was huge. They'd sell out crowds. Okay, they weren't playing in the biggest stadiums in Australia, but it was live on TV. And these girls, I got to know a couple of the girls that played for the Adelaide Crows, and, you know, they were telling they have two jobs, or like a job as well as playing the sport. And already in its first season, we can see there's this big push to change things. And as being in a sport that's embracing that, it's exciting. And, you know, we're never going to be content with, okay, here's something, we're happy with that. We need to keep pushing, because the second we say, yes, we're happy with everything, we're not going to keep seeing progression. And to keep everything moving forward, we need to push and strive for progression. And there is still a number of things that are holding us back, like in terms of, like, I would say television exposure. Certain countries are fantastic for it, like the UK, they're probably the top of the list. US do quite a good job. Australia, you know, we look at Cadel Evans' road race this year, like, it had live TV coverage on mainstream TV before the women's tennis final. Like, that was massive. To have that kind of exposure in Australia is probably some of the biggest exposure we've had in terms of one day races outside of, like, Olympics or World Championships. It's an exciting time, but as we say, you know, there is still a lot of negatives that we could say, but it's important to look at the positives of what is happening and then keep pushing and asking for more, to tell people, okay, we're happy that you're making an effort, but we want you to keep, you know, living up to promises.
It's interesting what you say about that, you know, it's evolved from being an individual sport into a team sport, and that's one of the things that makes it more interesting, intriguing. It's what, although it was a very dominant Dutch team at the World Championship, that team aspect to it made it, and it was their rare race to lose in a lot of ways. It was very impressive the way they executed that. And we've seen that in women's cycling over the last couple of years in particular, real proper team performances, teams working as teams. And a new thing even I think this year, this winter, has been a sort of an idea of a transfer market in women's cycling. You know, quite a lot of movement, people coming and going. Your team especially seems to be ringing the changes for next year. You're losing Lisa Brenner, who's been a real kind of figurehead for that team for a long time, in its various guises. But you've got coming in Alice Barnes and Cassia Nivia Doma. So what's that going to do for the team next year? You mentioned, when we were speaking earlier, about, you know, it's a strong team, strong riders. Hannah Barnes rode a very good World Championship road race, but perhaps lacking the winners.
Yeah, you know, it's exciting for our Can-Am racing team. We're obviously moving into our third season as its current squad and current name and everything else. And, you know, it was time for a change. We had two seasons where we were more or less the exact same team. We only had the one change from 2016 to 2017, bringing in Pauline Frampreau. But yeah, as you mentioned, a lot of time, like, we've had a lot of strong riders, but perhaps lacked that someone who's a proven winner. And, you know, when you have someone in a team, when you know that they're capable of winning a certain race, it's much easier to bring everyone else up, versus we're always being a very opportunistic team, but sometimes you need that extra bit of strength to then bring everyone up to that next level, and then you see everyone find another level from themselves. So, you know, obviously we've lost Lisa, who, she has been a very strong rider within the team, a great teammate, but she was also ready for a change, you know, and I think it's going to be great for her, you know, changing over to Wiggle, and it will change their dynamic of the team. For us, as you said, like, we've got now Alice Barnes, who's a fantastic up-and-coming rider. You know, she's a great sprinter and sort of a good all-round classics type rider. We have Lisa Klein, current German champion, another young rider, but we've already seen some strong and promising results from her. And then obviously Cassio is probably the most exciting signing that we have. You know, when I've been asked by the team, you know, who we think we should get, I've always mentioned her name because I think she's a fantastic rider. She's great for the sport. She's not afraid to go and attack it, but sometimes she's been lacking that strength. I think bringing her into the team with Pauline getting back to her best, and Hannah obviously stepped up a huge amount. And I think collectively, if you look at our team on paper, we have the ability to do some pretty special things next year, I think. And having the core group of riders staying together, because also Eleanor Cicchini, for example, she had a great start of the season. Aliona's always been a strong climber. She's lacked maybe having the support in the climbs. And now we're kind of touching bases of being covered in all areas. And again, like Alexis, you know, another great young rider, has a lot of potential. And collectively, we have a great group and an exciting group. And, you know, not to mention like Trixie Warwick as well. Like, she's been in cycling for a very, very, very long time, even longer than me. But she's got that huge amount of experience that she can bring to the team and help guide these younger riders that we're getting. And so, you know, I'm excited for what we can do, and I believe like we're going to have a successful year next year, you know, with this bit of fresh approach, because it's what we need within the team, I think.
You said that you felt that Cassia maybe and Oviedo-Ma didn't have the team strength last year to deliver on her early season promise. Do you think that's something that Canyon SRAM can help provide for her, and what do you think she can achieve on the team next year?
Yeah, I believe 100%, you know, Cassia coming to her team, like, we have a lot of good riders that are good in the classics. We have good riders who can support her in, you know, the Ardennes. I believe she has potential, you know, to win a lot of the big races. Like, you look at how consistent she was in the Ardennes. And as we've mentioned before, I'm very good friends with Lizzie Deignan. And, you know, she said to me a few times in those races, like, Cassie was the strongest. But, you know, when she's against two bowls riders, it's pretty hard to come up against that to win the bike race. And, you know, if we can go in there and give her, like, even just one rider extra support at the business end, that will make a huge difference when you can match the numbers of, say, the likes of Bowles, or, you know, Sunweb stepped up as a team this year or really, really strong in, particularly in the classic season. And even Orica, you know, they were quite strong this year. So at the end of the day, it comes to a numbers game. And if we can support someone like Cassia with extra numbers, so then she can play her strength to make that race winning move instead of trying to break the opposition, you know, I think we'll see her win a lot of bike races.
You rode in the past for Orica, Green Edge, as it was. Obviously, there's a male and a female team. How did you enjoy being part of that larger squad? Was there a lot of integration? Did you feel a part of that? And what are your thoughts on, you know, some of the men's teams have women's teams. Movistar will have a women's team next year. We talked about this a bit in the last podcast about, you know, how there's this clamour for, you know, make all men's teams have women's teams. But as the Drops sponsor were pointing out, as Bulls Dolmans were pointing out as well, that would deprive them of an opportunity to have a team competing at the highest level.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big supporter of men's teams who want to have women's teams. Like, I think that's great. And, you know, it adds certain elements of support because you can work off of the same sponsors in terms of the exposure. It opens up the audiences and brings a bit of the men's audience to the women in terms of the equipment and everything else. You know, we've always, like when I was with Orica, we had a lot of, you know, the top equipment. We were never deprived of that. But you can also be a very successful women's team on its own. And we've proved that with the Canyon SRAM Racing team, and Bowles have proved that. And number, it's all about how you do your marketing and how your sponsors want to treat you. Like, I still don't believe we should force men's teams to have women's teams, because at the end of the day, they're not going to give it the support if they don't want to have it. You know, it's good, the ones that have. Like, when I was with Orica, it was great, particularly on the Australian public, because we did have that great exposure, but you can often get overshadowed by the men as well. Like, we didn't have so much to do with them throughout the season. Like, yeah, sure, in a training camp sometimes, or certain races would be together, but a lot of time they were two very individualized programs. Whereas, you know, if you have sponsors that believe in 100% women's program, as we've seen, like with both Canyon, SRAM have always been so supportive, RAFA as well, you know, like, they've obviously moved away from Sky, and now we're their only police world tour team that they have on the books. And you need sponsors that believe in that, that want to, you know, reach new audiences, and that's the way to successfully grow. And, you know, like some Movistar having a team, that's fantastic for the support. You know, it's great that it will open up the audience in Spain, but I still don't believe every team needs to have a women's team on the side of it. Like, everything has its pros and cons. So there are certainly good things about it, but also cons as well, like, because you're overshadowed quite often by the men if it is you sharing with the men in the women platform.
Can I ask what you think, or if you have much of an opinion on the new president, Mr. Laparchion? He, as every campaigning, well, not every campaigning president, but his predecessor certainly, came in as well with a promise for women's cycling. We saw under Laparchion, when he was the president of the French Federation, that a number of the women's races went by the wayside, including in his own territory in Brittany. But he's talking about introducing a minimum wage for the women. I mean, he's already increased the men's minimum wage, so he's done that first.
Yep.
How do you view his promises and his promise as a president for the women's side of the sport?
If I'm completely honest, I haven't followed the presidency so much, even though I know that I should because it's very important.
Is it important then, though?
Well, it's important to know what's going on within the sport, you know, because if they're guiding our sport, we have to believe in what their missions are. As you know, obviously, I've been in the sport for quite a long time. Sometimes I have to be a voice for the sport and, you know, speak up for our sport. So if there are times where maybe I have to come across him and have a conversation or go through, you know, we've seen more women's commissions starting to come together to try and give us more of a voice to go to, you know, the governing bodies. Because again, at the end of the day, they control so much of the sport. So if we don't have their support, our sport is still going to get hindered. We can do as much as we want from our side through, as we say, the sponsors, through social media, through everything else. But if we don't have the governing body support, we're not going to get anywhere, do we? So if he's promising these things, that's great. But I will believe it when I see it. Like, as we saw with Cookson, he promised so many things, but did he follow through with many of them? A lot of things, no. Certain things, yes, he did good for the sport. But like with all presidents everywhere in the world, they all like to promise things to get the vote. But, you know, what makes a true and good president is when we see the change, when we see the difference. Like if we do see minimum wage introduced, which I think is important, but we also need to be careful with that as well, because we don't want to say here's minimum wage and then suddenly teams can't filter that. Like I'd rather us see, okay, get the level so we have the exposure, so the sponsors have enough backing to give the team the support and the money that they need. So then, yes, we can say, okay, the sport's at a level where we can give them this much money that they can promise. Like, it's everything is in progression. It's like the chicken and the egg.
So I think it's important not to impose these things if organically it's not the right time for it to happen, really.
100%. Like, of course, all of us would love to say, yes, I want to get paid minimum this much money, because we all want money in our bank account. We all want to be able to do this professionally. And I think we are slowly but surely getting to that point and seeing more teams that have the right budgets. But at the end of the day, we also don't want the sport to completely fall apart because teams don't have the budget. Like, I still believe with the Women's World Tour, now it's been 2 years and obviously we'll be in our third year next year. The reason World Tour teams should have to be able to operate a certain level, and I believe we need those kind of minimums. And then with that, I should say, okay, if you're a World Tour team, you need to be able to pay a minimum, but we still need to make sure that teams are getting enough exposure through the UCI by saying to racers, no, if you want to be a World Tour race, you must give live TV or something like this, because yeah, it's collectively everything that needs to work together to make things happen, I believe.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our main sponsor. Always grateful to them, of course. And should be available now, the new Pedaleuse de Charme range.
I haven't got mine yet.
No, it'll be coming, or a lot. but yeah, go to rafa.cc or the shop on the cyclingpodcast.com. Click on shop and it'll take you to our page on the Rafa website where you can buy Pedaleuse de Charme. And now, by popular request, Pedaleuse de Charme.
Popular request by me.
Actually, this reminds me, and I'd almost forgotten this, but we are going to award a Pedaleuse de Charme for the year from the women's peloton. So what we're going to do is we're going to do a Twitter poll, a shortlist, and get you to vote.
Let's get Tiffany's nomination.
Who'd be your nomination?
So who was the best rider of the year?
Yeah.
Well, Pedaleuse de Charme is a bit more than that. It's something about, like, you know, elegance, class. It can be
personality. It can be how they live their lives, how they conduct themselves as on and off the bike. It's a bit intangible.
I'll say Chantelle Block, just because I think she's a worthy, good world champion. She looks good for our sport, and she's a lovely person as well.
great.
And she was Dutch national champion too, which, you know how hard it is to win that jersey.
So she
almost as hard as the world, isn't it?
Yeah, really.
So we haven't got long now before we have to get our flight. Tiffany's been reassuring us that we've got loads of time. My rule of thumb is never trust a bike rider with that
Says
sort
the man
of
who almost made us miss our flight here.
Yeah, true. Anyway, we will have to
You'll
dash
make
off
it.
Quite soon. But Tiffany, we just wanted to ask you about life here in Monaco. You've been here for a while now. It's a real hub for cycling. Lizzie Diagonan is here. Abby May Parkinson is nearby as well. But a lot of male riders here as well. I mean, do you train alone a lot? Do you train with some of these other people?
You know, it's quite a mix throughout the year. It depends on the time of the year as well. At times, you know, there's no one here, and other times we have lots of people here. Obviously, Lizzie, she is probably my key training buddy. Certainly been through a lot with her. She's not only my friend on the bike, but off the bike, you know, probably my best friend that I have. So we certainly do some Ks together. Outside of that, yeah, I train with some of the boys sometimes, you know, I'll go for a ride with Ian Boswell sometimes. Michael Matthews is here on the occasion. Phil Dignan too. Dave Tanner is based down here. Like, you could name, like, on our off-season, actually, so now coming in as people start to train again, some of the bunches are quite impressive. Yeah, it's like the who's who. I remember when I first ever moved down here and, you know, like, we had, like, Tom Boonen, and we had, you know, then motorsport people too, like Troy Bayliss, Philip Gilbert, all these people. And, like, back then I was this, 22-year-old, I was like, you know, still, like, a bit of a fangirl. Now it becomes a bit more normal, but we're also lucky we have a lot of the motorsport community down here, and I enjoy riding with them sometimes, like serve, you know, Jensen Button is now living more in the US, but used to train quite a bit with him, and he's very, very handy on the bike. Fellow Australian Mark Webber's just moved down here, so, you know, I'm sure we'll find ourselves doing some cycling.
Do you ever? I mean, I know that you are quite prolific on Instagram, and you'll sometimes post those kinds of pictures, but do you ever look around your training bunch and think, I've made it, this is the life?
Yeah, sometimes. You know, when you do think about it, and you like to some people, like, these are their absolute heroes, they're like untouchable. Like, I remember in the early years when you first time you go riding with the F1 drivers, because it's funny how, like, all the cyclists are huge fans of the motorsport guys, and all the motorsport guys are huge fans of the cyclists. It's like, we all wish we could be in each other's worlds. And there were times like that where it's like, oh, pinch me kind of thing. But what's also great is at the end of the day, there's so much that you can relate to them to. Like, they're all very normal people, but they all understand the pressures of being a top athlete, the pressures of performance. But you can also switch off instead of just being stuck in this cycling bubble. So, you know, before I pro didn't follow all the various, like, there's actually that many different car categories, you know, that you don't realise, like, from rally to F1 to, you know, endurance racing to GT to all this. And before that, I had no idea. Now, because I know the guys, it's like, oh yeah, oh, so you do this one, you do that one, and you follow it more, which is nice, because you follow it because you know the people, and then, you know, we'll have a cook up or a barbecue, and yeah, like, we all live the kind of same transient lifestyle, so it can be a Tuesday and we're out, you know, for an evening barbecue, whereas a normal person, no, you can't do that because you have to work the next day. So that's what I love down here, because, you know, when you live the other side of the world, you know, obviously I moved from Australia, it can be a lonely life. You have to learn to create a new life somewhere else, and community is the most important thing. Like, without the community that I have here, like, so many of the girls, guys, everyone, you know, I'd be lost. And, you know, when you have those down times, those dark moments, it's them who are here that help you. And, you know, that's probably been the thing that I love most about being here, because people understand that lifestyle. They understand how it is. And, you know, it's a crazy world down here. Okay, we're super sport. Like, as you can see, it's an October day and 20 degrees and clear blue skies. It's beautiful. But the training as well is amazing. Like, you go down the coast, you've got the mountains, you've got the water, we got the airport 25 minutes. It's, for me, it's the perfect place to be based in my career.
You've got the airport in 25 minutes. I like that. If only. Speaking of the airport being 25 minutes away, we are going to have to, unfortunately, wrap things up. But
we haven't even got to chat about your beer.
Mention your beer. Yeah, you're involved in a beer, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so we've also started a brand new craft brewery project with myself and some of the other athletes. As you said, like Daniel Ricciardo, Jensen Button, Tor Hushoff, Andreas Mikkelsen, Noah Wiley, an actor. So it's set up. It's in Nice. We have a tap room, but the plan is, you know, we got four different brews, an IPA, a session ale, a blonde, and one other that I should know.
craft lager?
Yeah, a craft. Yeah, lager, actually. Yeah. We're going to serve it all down the south of France, and, you know, big for, like, the GP and stuff like that. But it's basically, the hashtag is where I belong, and we're embracing the lifestyle that craft beer lives, the Côte d'Azur lifestyle, the sporting lifestyle. You know, it's about having fun, having a great group of people involved, and creating great beer that people want to drink. So
drink like ever, a champ.
Now you've got me interested.
Next time you're in the south of France, you have to ask for a Blue Coast beer.
Blue Coast.
Yeah,
Blue Coast beer. We'll get you a tin for the train.
Yeah, exactly.
Excellent. Well, we better dash Orla because we do have a plane to catch. But Tiffany, thank you very much indeed for meeting us and speaking so eloquently about all these different things that are going on in your own life here and life in cycling. It's been really fascinating.
It's been brilliant. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you very much. Hopefully
thanks
we can do it again.
Along.
Maybe
yeah,
over
definitely.
A beer.
Let's come back to Monaco, get a Blue Coast beer. Do you do non-alcoholic ones?
No.
Is there an
option?
Is that like a future...
No. Probably not, no. Okay. If it's beer, we're going to have alcohol. But there's a blonde, which is quite light. So, you know, the idea is to have much lighter ones.
Okay, let's wrap things up. We're back next month with a sponsorship special, I think. And we'll be with you then, Orla and I. Thank
Probably
you.
Probably in the rain.
Thank you, Orla.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tiffany.
Thanks.
You are listening to the cycling podcast Femina, supported by Rafa. Celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.